There's a story that I found in the Journal of Public Health, which I read never, okay? But I found it from an article online in 1992. If I think back to 1992, where were you in 1992? Anybody? What were you doing? High school? College? Just got your first job? Not even born? Maybe? Some of us? I was born then, just in case you thought I was real young, but I'm not. I was still finishing up high school then, actually kind of starting high school then. But this, what's funny about this article from the Journal of Public Health is they're examining the question of what makes a community healthy. And they went from 1992, when this article was published, they went all the way back to 1960s. And there's a story, a general practitioner who's the head of the medicine department at the University of Oklahoma, there's this GP and then a GP who is practicing medicine in that town, and they're at a restaurant and they're having this conversation about heart disease. And one of them says, well, heart disease seems much less prevalent in the town of Rosetto than in its neighbor, town called Bangor. So they started doing some research on these two towns, Rosetto and Bangor. And Rosetto was a town of 1,600 Italian Americans. Every home in the town had three generations living in it, right? So kids, parents, grandparents. And the sense of community in this town was really tight, according to this article. Then the article says this: teams of medical researchers spent time in Rosetto trying to determine why the rate of heart attack was so much lower than in nearby Bangor. Was it diet? No. Rosettans shared a typical American diet. Was it genes? No. Other Italian communities had heart attack rates similar to the national average. Was it healthy habits? No. Rosettans smoked as much as people in neighboring towns and exercised as little as people in neighboring towns and met the national average for obesity and high blood pressure. Was it the physical environment? No. There was no significant difference between Rosetto and neighboring towns. Was it a short-term statistical anomaly? No. The trend held up over a 50-year study. In the end, health officials tracked the secret to good health in Rosetto, and the article says, ready for it? A close sense of community. A close sense of community. Very strong bonds of family and friendship. The head of the research team wrote in his report, quote, in terms of preventing heart disease, it is just possible that morale is more important than jogging or not eating butter. Interestingly, the initial research team predicted that the health benefits would diminish as successive generations Americanized and lost their tight-knit sense of community. A 50-year study found their prediction to be accurate. Isn't that unfortunate that they coined the term, they used the term Americanized as they lost their tight sense, their tight-knit sense of community. They lost it. That's really unfortunate. So we're talking about hospitality, and I want to center in on a few passages of Scripture that have to do with what Jesus is doing with his disciples in the context of the Jewish nation that he's a part of as a Jewish rabbi. And I want to center in on Luke chapter 5, verses 27 through 29. This is where Jesus, it's the story of Jesus and Levi. Okay, so it says Jesus went out, Luke chapter 5, we'll put it up on the screen, but if you want to look at it in your scriptures or on your device, you can do that too. Jesus went out and saw a man named Levi at his work collecting taxes. Jesus said, come along with me, and he did. He walked away from everything and went with him. Levi gave a large dinner at his home for Jesus. Everybody was there, taxmen and disreputable characters as guests at the dinner. This offended the religious leaders. In other words, I got really mad that Jesus invited disreputable people to his home, because they knew that accepting an invitation to someone's home and sharing in a meal implied they could be included in one's life. That's what I would say. So first thing I want you to realize is that hospitality, which we're going to define in a minute, it has the power to define relationship. how hospitable you are, if you're hospitable at all, can define relationship. And Jesus jumps right into the fray and goes with those who are not, you're not supposed to have a relationship with these people in their society at the time. What we see Jesus doing in Scripture, and we're going to point out some other stories, is that he used homes and meals to define and declare where God actually was. And by that I mean, Jesus is God incarnate. And everywhere he goes, he's trying to show everybody who's around him, this is what God is up to, this is who God loves, this is who God wants us to be with. And so he's like, God shows up wherever I go and whatever I'm doing, okay? And so he says, Jesus is using homes and meals to define and declare where God actually was. And he's eating meals with peasants. He's eating meals with prostitutes, which in early Jewish culture was the ultimate. When you eat with somebody, that is the ultimate expression of fellowship. And his choices were in such sharp contrast to the religious leaders. So Jesus understood that it is in this way of hospitality that we are communicating something. We are communicating this. My life is not fundamentally separated from your life or any other person's life. And he is, as God incarnate, saying, my life is attached to your life, to the people's lives who supposedly didn't matter or who were untouchable. He basically says, I will identify myself with you. There's this basic level of inclusion in life, and that is precisely why all of the leaders were shocked and why they were upset, and it was so controversial. And it was life-changing to the others who were included, right? Think about if you're a tax collector who's shunned or a prostitute who nobody wants to have anything to do with, and Jesus says, I want you to be in my life. And they're like, a rabbi wants to be in my life? And not only that, he tells the other religious leaders who are pointing their fingers, he says, you're wrong. You're totally wrong. That's life-changing for those people. So we see it again in Acts chapter 10. If you want to turn to Acts chapter 10, I'm not going to put this on the screen, but this is the story of Peter, who's following Jesus' example, and he's invited to the home of Cornelius, the Roman centurion, someone who's not Jewish, someone who's a soldier in the Roman army who is oppressing the people of God, the Jews. And what we find here is this is one of the first disciples that's called to a home of a Roman centurion, a Gentile. And it becomes a defining moment for what God was doing in the life of the early church. Could Peter, as a Jew, enter into the home of a Gentile? The traditional answer was no way. You cannot go there. All right? Could this powerful Roman authority welcome what this Jewish man had to offer? The traditional answer was no way. Neither one of them could accept what the other one had to offer. Neither one of them could become enmeshed or entangled in a friendship or anything like that. But God leads Peter through these tensions and into Cornelius' home. And the next day, if you read that story in Acts chapter 10, the entire household comes to God. The entire household accepts this story about Jesus, who he was, what he was about, how he lived. The whole process, though, was about Peter choosing to enter that home. The power of hospitality lies in the significance of inclusion. Who are you going to include in your life? Are you excluding people from your life? Hospitality is an expression of inclusion. It means including others in a common bond of care. It's really defined how we welcome those who are new or newer into our lives. Are we gonna welcome a guest or a stranger into our home? The Latin root of the word hospitality is the word hospes. I'm gonna put this slide up here for the definition that talks about hospitality. The word hospes in Latin refers to a guest or a visitor, a host or a stranger. And our word, there's cognates in English for the Latin and Greek words. We have the word, where do we go when we're sick? The hospital, Okay? Hospital comes from the Latin word hospitale. That word in Latin meant a guest house or an inn. And the word hospice meant stranger or guest. And there were words that were combined together. The Greek word espios came from the noun estio, which meant home or house or family. And from that word estia comes the verb estieo, which means to receive or welcome somebody in my house, to prepare a meal for somebody, to offer hospitality. This is from the American Heritage Dictionary. It simply says, welcoming guests with warmth and generosity. It's a pretty good definition. It also continues on. The definition says, and well-disposed toward strangers. Toward strangers. So the main part of the word hospitality is the word hospital. Ancient travelers needed a place to stay. So church leaders in the first centuries, they established these houses, where these kind of guest houses that were called hospitals. And it's where we get the term hospice, like hospice care, caring for a stranger, giving them warmth and care in a time of need. Originally, the word hospital literally meant a haven for guests. A haven for guests. And unfortunately, we've lost that concept today. We've taken what was meant to be a haven for guests, our homes. Homes were meant to be a haven for guests. And we've turned it into a haven from guests. Did you catch that? Like, my home is where I go to be away from everyone. And there's part of that that's appropriate, that has to do with boundaries. But there's something that has been lost on the flip side of that as well. Too often, our homes are places where we can just get away from people. We treat our homes, I heard one theologian talk about it like this, we treat our homes like modern-day castles, right? We come home, we drive across the driveway, or in our case, we drive into our alleys or just on the street. and then we run into our house. We drive into our castles, and we lower the portcullis, and we raise the drawbridge, and we fill up the moat with water or liquid hot magma, and we say, keep out, you know, keep out. Beth and I used to live in the suburbs back in Boise, Idaho, and in Meridian, Idaho, and it was like everybody had, believe it or not, it's totally unlike Seattle, or at least West Seattle, everybody had two and three car garages, right? And they would fill like two of the sides of the garage with a bunch of stuff that they needed to put into a storage place. And then they would be able to park one car in there. But they would drive into their spot and then they would close the garage door before they even got out of the car. So you would never see them. They're like, hey, bye. You know, type of thing. We've lost something. People are searching and lonely. And they don't know where they can go where they'll be accepted. They don't know places of hospitality anymore. And in fact, rightly deserved, some churches have reputations where people are like, I don't want to have anything to do with you because you're not hospitable. I feel judged. I feel evil. I feel dirty for going there. I don't need you to tell me that. I just need to be loved. And that's what we are trying to attempt to be here. It's what we've always tried to attempt to be. We have to give people, there's power in giving people a place where they belong. It is why we put on a lot of our stuff, you belong here. You belong here. You truly belong here. We want to give people a place to belong. We want to lower our walls and open our doors. The Greek word for hospitality, we talked about the Latin word, but the Greek word is philoxenia. Let's put that up there for a minute. Philoxenia. That's the Greek word for hospitality. It's a compound word. Means brotherly love for a stranger. Philo means brotherly love, philo. And xenos means stranger, someone other than you, right? We have another word, xenophobia, anyone different than you. But this word, philoxenia, means the love of a stranger. So that's what hospitality literally means in Greek. The love of a stranger, for a stranger. It goes all the way back to what God originally intended for his people in the Old Testament. He wants his people to love others, which was a concept that was just so other than everything else that was going on in the Old Testament. Okay? It goes all the way back. If you look at Leviticus chapter 19, verse 34, there's the very distinctive desire of God for his people that set them apart from all other tribes of people at that time. It says, you shall not treat the stranger who resides among you in your land. You shall not mistreat them. The stranger residing among you must be treated as if he were native born. Love them as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So Jesus presses this point of inclusion in all that he did. He takes that notion in the Old Testament that the people of God were set apart to include other people and be a safe haven, a place where those who were lost or were hurting could come and find help. He takes that and he lives that way amongst the Jews of his time. And it was his greatest offense. He offended all the good, God-fearing Jews by living the way God said he wanted them to live. You know? So one night while having dinner at one of the religious leaders' homes in Luke chapter 14, if you want to turn there, Luke chapter 14, let's put this up on the screen, verses 12 through 14. Jesus, right before this passage, he is practicing Sabbath. He's on the Sabbath and he heals somebody. And they're like, you can't heal somebody on the Sabbath. And he like puts them in their place and says, what's wrong with you? This person needs help. You want to make it wait till tomorrow? They might be dead, you know, something like that. He's eating a meal in the house of a prominent Pharisee, okay, one of the elite, verse 12. And it says this, and he turned to the host. The next time you put on a dinner, don't just invite your friends and family and rich neighbors, the kind of people who will return the favor. Invite some people who never get invited out. Invite some people who never get invited out. The misfits from the wrong side of the tracks. You'll be and experience a blessing. They won't be able to return the favor, but the favor will be returned. Oh, how it will be returned at the resurrection of God's people. There's a lot of versions that read this a little bit differently. I just read to you from the Message version, but some of the versions actually say, there is no place for friends. In there. It says there is no place for friends. What Jesus is really saying in verse 12, it should read literally, do not always keep inviting your friends. That's what it says in the Greek. Do not always keep inviting your friends. Make room for others. You need to have some margin for others. So he's not saying don't ever get together with family and friends. He did that himself. He's not just saying don't ever do that. His point is that if you want to share in what God is doing, if you want to join up with what God's doing in the neighborhood, don't exclusively restrict your invitation list to just your friends or your family members. Don't be a junior hire who's always looking to, their primary goal is how do I fit in and how can I be cool? You might say, oh no, it's not. My junior hire doesn't want to be cooler. That wasn't me. I didn't want to be cool. Yeah, you were trying to be cool by not being cool. Okay? The lens you're always looking for, and we're totally different because we're all grown up now, right? Is how can I be cool by being with the cool people? And we resent that when we see that in movies, when we see just the cool people hanging out and excluding others. But we're all guilty of it to some degree or another. His point was, don't exclusively restrict your invitation list to just your family or friends. Neighbors who you don't know well are a good place to start. We've talked about one of our rhythms as neighboring as a church. How do we get into the rhythm of neighboring? Who are your neighbors? Do you know their names? We put up that chart a few weeks ago where we said, put your house in the middle of the chart. Can you put a name on every house around your house? Do you know their names? Do you know their kids' names? Do you know their pets' names? Do you know their birthdays? Do you know if they just lost a job or a loved one? Neighboring. And then, how are you going to show them hospitality? If they show you hospitality, please take advantage of it. Get involved and get into their life in some way. So practicing hospitality shows us that there is power in presence. There is power in listening, according to what Jesus is telling his Pharisees. There is power in caring for others. All of those things are what hospitality is about. But we also begin to see that hospitality is prophetic in the sense that it points to an eternal reality. An eternal reality. And what I'm talking about there is Jesus continues to describe God's invitation in that section. If you read right before the story that he tells, go out into the streets and invite everybody who's not at the party, basically. He describes God's invitation as an invitation to a grand banquet. Okay? It's a massive banquet. He's basically like, we're going to have a Yahweh Palooza, okay? A festival that God is throwing. And the whole scene declares who God is and what he's doing and what he's done and how much he loves us. And eternal reality is reflected in a banquet. You are invited. God is showing you. He is showing me. He is showing us hospitality. He does not have to. He could just be like, I'm God. I don't need to send you Jesus. I could leave you to your own devices and not come to my party. And only those who earn it get to come in. And he says, no, I'm going to extend this to everyone. And by everyone, he means everyone. I want everyone to come to this party. Now, you can choose to come to the party or not, but he's like, I'm inviting all of you. Everyone is included. Hear me now. This is at the center of Jesus' heart, of what it means to live like Jesus. Inviting others in. Making space for others. Inclusion. Invitation. Hospitality. We see it all over in the New Testament scriptures. It's about belonging and extending that belonging to others. I want to show you a quote. I just read this last week from Brené Brown in her book, Braving the Wilderness. She says, true belonging is not passive. It's not the belonging that comes with just joining a group. It's not fitting in or pretending or selling out because it's safer, i.e. junior high. It's a practice that requires us to be vulnerable, get uncomfortable, and learn how to be present with people without sacrificing who we are. We want true belonging, but it takes tremendous courage to knowingly walk into hard moments. For some of us, it's hard just to say hi to your neighbor who's getting out of their car across the street. For some of us, it's hard to say, hey, we've known each other, we've been neighbors for like 10 years, but we've never like had a barbecue or anything. We've never talked about anything of substance other than, hey, you know, did you see that thing in the Seattle Times and talk about it for a minute? Like, we haven't gone deeper, and why not? It takes tremendous courage to knowingly walk into hard moments and practice hospitality, which is going to lead to true belonging for yourself and for others. So Jesus is actually practicing true belonging when he sits in that meal at the Pharisee's house and he says, I can heal this person, and God is inviting you into something much bigger and grander. It's about more than just your little table that you've made exclusive, and you won't invite certain people into it because they don't fit into whatever you picture your life as being about. It's about this other table that I'm going to invite everyone to, is what Jesus is saying. He's practicing true belonging. He knows who he is. He knows hospitality is a distinctive of God's character. When God says, I'm inviting everybody, he's saying, this is who I am. Everyone is invited. God makes himself vulnerable because he's God. He's beautiful and he's perfect and he's righteous and he's holy. And he says, I'm going to invite you who are not like me to come to my party. Now go and do the same. So practicing hospitality now is prophetic. And that means it's shaping us for the grand banquet in the future, in the age to come. It's shaping us. So we extend hospitality because it's extended to us in and through Jesus. And we want to live like Jesus, right? You want to live like Jesus? You just want to say you want to be like him and not do anything. You want to put some handholds on your faith, practice hospitality. Jesus' model shaped the thinking and practice. The thinking and the practice. The being and the doing of the early church. They didn't just sit around in little monasteries thinking about what to do. Even when you typically think of a monk cloistering themselves away, they were supposed to do work in the community and serve the community that they were a part of. So for Jesus, a main characteristic of hospitality was not only to open your home and your life to your friends, but to the stranger, to the people you don't know, so that they can belong and become your friend, so that they can become your family. I want to put it a different way. One of the main characteristics of Jesus' way of hospitality is that you live in an ever-increasing, larger circle of relationships. It should be ever-increasing. You should be, by the time you're living in an assisted care facility, making friends there till the last day and inviting them to live the way of Jesus. It never ends. This was recognized so much by the early church that they made it part of being a recognized leader within the church family. Did you hear me? You want to be an elder in a church, a New Testament church, now and back then, you will practice hospitality. Read 1 Timothy 3:2. Read Titus chapter 1, 7 through 8. It made the list of the main criteria of who was to be a leader in the church. You must practice hospitality. And leaders, their job is to raise up other leaders. If you haven't figured this out yet, being a disciple of Jesus, where he says, you can be like me, means he's raising you up to be a leader like him. And then your job is then, in turn, to raise up leaders like you, in as much as you are shaped like Jesus. Meaning, we all are being trained in hospitality. Okay? It was required of leaders to be hospitable. No one could be considered a leader if they were not hospitable, if they weren't practicing it. Again, those references, 1 Timothy 3:2 and Titus 1, 7 through 8. Basically, if you reread these passages that we've read, if you read about Cornelius and you read about Jesus at Levi's party after he calls him, if you read about Jesus being in the home of the Pharisee, if you read about Jesus calling Zacchaeus down out of the tree, the chief tax collector, and he's like, I'm going to go be with you. And everybody's like, oh, no, you didn't. And he's like, yes, I did. Jesus is saying that the practice of hospitality is evidence that we actually know him as Savior. And the lack of hospitality is evidence that you do not. Ouch. Okay? The practice of hospitality is evidence that we actually know him as Savior, and the lack of hospitality is evidence that we do not. One way of looking at this is that, I'll put this up on the screen for you as well, the whole Bible is the story of divine hospitality, of God graciously extending to us an invitation to be with him, to join up with him, to party with him, to do good work with him. It's the story of God's invitation, defined by inclusion. He's like, guess what? I made all of you in my image. I want to be with you. Our tendency, though, is to think in terms of what we must do, what must emanate from us, and as such, that we have to create a hospitable, inclusive world. The reality is that Jesus, that God has already created an inclusive, hospitable world. It already exists. It is the very life that Jesus extends to us, invites us to enter. He's telling us this story. Jesus makes clear that God is the grand host. And that is really, really important for us as a church, for any Christian to understand that God is a grand host. He wants to invite everyone into the family. He loves everyone. And while the world is intensifying over the nature of relationship towards foreigners and aliens, the biblical storyline reminds us that we have all been foreigners and aliens in terms of how God sees us. We've all been in such a relationship to God and his eternal kingdom. If we receive Jesus, though, we enter into God's household. We enter into his family. And then we can extend that invitation to others to enter into the home as well. What I'm trying to say is the Bible reflects the understanding that truth, the truth of who God is and who Jesus is exclusive. God says, there's no other way to me except through Jesus. He says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. That truth is exclusive. But then Jesus turns around and says, but my love for everyone and my invitation to everyone, that is not exclusive. That is entirely and utterly inclusive. Okay? It's your choice. Do you want to accept the invitation? Let your heart, Jesus' heart needs to get into our heart, and then our heart needs to flow from God's hospitality to us. He's given us hospitality. So that's important, because hospitality is not this work that we need to do, that we need to work hard at in order to earn something. And it's not an obligation. I would say it this way: direct your heart from the motivation of mere obligation to that of extending what God is doing. God is already up to this, and all you need to do is extend the invitation. You need to join him in it. You don't need to create it. He's already created this thing called hospitality. Another point about that's very practical about hospitality is that includes, but is not limited to, your house. It includes, but is not limited to, your house or wherever you live. The nature of hospitality sees a huge significance in your home, because our homes are the most notable expression of how we are a family. If I invite someone into my home, I'm saying, you're included. You are included. The meals that are served there express that in a really essential way. If you invite someone to your home and you share a meal, you are saying, you're part of this. You're my friend. I'm connected to you. I'm tied to you. So, but it's helpful to ask, does our home or wherever you live, condo or an apartment, does it express inclusion to others? Hospitality is not just about your living spaces. There are ways that we can extend ourselves to others. There are other ways that you can extend your home that don't necessarily have to do with inviting them into your space. Okay, consider getting to know your neighbor, doing some neighboring, and you figure out that they have a need that they can't get done on their own, but you can meet that need by doing something for them or arranging something for them. Consider the transitions people may be in. This transit, the main transition that's always coming going on here in West Seattle, is people are moving in and they're moving out. People are moving in and they're moving out all the time. You probably have seen this on your street multiple times for as long as you've lived here, even if you've lived here for just a little while. People are always moving in, moving out. Almost every day that I drive or walk up and down California, you can see people moving in and moving out. There are like pods being delivered and picked up. There are moving trucks right in the middle of the center lane being unloaded. And people are by them. I see people by themselves, no moving company, leaving all their stuff unattended while they have to walk into their apartment or their condo and get it all in there. I mean, what if we were the church that one of you called me and said, I just found this family and I have the time and it's Saturday. They're moving in. They don't have any help and I'm here. Can you round up the troops? And we all went over and we were known for that. What if that was us? And there's many other ways we could be known. Somebody moves in and they rent a home and they came from another part of the city and they don't have a lawnmower and now they don't have the money for a lawnmower and person who owns their home, the landlord, is like, you have to mow the lawn. They don't have a lawnmower. How many of you have a lawnmower? Not very many. Right? What if we let people borrow our lawnmowers? What if we were the church that was known for letting people borrow lawnmowers, amongst other things? How many of you need a lawnmower? I have a lawnmower. You can borrow it. Okay? People are in constant flux and transition. They're getting married. They're getting divorced. They're having kids. They're starting a job. All of these are opportunities to connect with someone. They move in, you bring them cookies, you bring them a pie, you invite them for dinner. You say, we're having a barbecue. You say, my group of my people at my church, no pressure, you can come, just have a meal. All we do is pray. We get to know each other better. We plan how we might serve the community together. If that sounds good to you, come on over. You know, you bring the wine. We'll bring everything else. Whatever. Or you can simply choose to include someone at work in the lunch plans of everyone else who you know is not included, right? We read a lot of Berenstain Bears books in our family. They're really good. If you haven't read them in a while, you should read them. Go to the library and check a few out, or just sit down and read them. They're quite excellent. And there's this one, I have most of them memorized now, but there's this one where Sister Bear and a group of friends are at school. There's a new girl at school named Susie, who's sitting down by the tree reading, and she has this forlorn look on her face, and Sister Bear, she knew that Susie was a new student, but she hadn't really befriended her. And she looks over and she's like, she looks sad. I think I should include her with my group of friends. She says, hey, come play with me. And pretty soon, Susie's just part of the crew, you know. And it creates some jealousy, actually, but that's not the point of it. The point is that she's included. It's just a beautiful moment where someone who's on the outside of the circle is invited into an ever-widening group of friends. It's an open circle. And they invite Susie into the life of the group. That's what we need to be about. Another thing, hospitality appreciates the significance of offering what is special, but is centered on the simple. So I want to get at this point in a kind of a roundabout way. But Jesus talks about banquets, and we typically think about banquets. We think about this big group setting where you have to entertain, okay? Where you have to entertain. And that's not what he's saying, because Jesus is also about the basics. He also says in another place in Scripture, just offering somebody a cup of cold water goes way further than you can possibly imagine, okay? And that's hospitality. Some of you may think your house is too messy, or your apartment is too small, or I have no time to keep it up. Some of you may think that you have to be rich to show hospitality. Some of you, and that's not true, some of the most hospitable lives in this world are the people with the least, right? God does not care about the square footage of your house. Let's put it that way. He doesn't care. He doesn't care about the square footage of your house. He does not care how messy it is. What I'm saying is it's important not to confuse hospitality with entertaining. Entertaining can focus on making it a special setting. And there are times for that where you might want to entertain and have a special setting, right? Hospitality, on the other hand, is about inviting people into your life just as you are. Hospitality is walking into the living room just a couple minutes before people arrive at your house and kicking out all the kids' toys into the other room or behind the couch and putting some taquitos in the microwave. And I know everybody, that's not socially acceptable. Like, I have to buy my stuff from Met Market, you know, and it has to be awesome. But I'm going to microwave these taquitos because even though they're not healthy, everyone likes them. Okay? Hospitality is sharing whatever you're having, even if it's just leftovers, right? That's what it is. And being okay to do that. In other words, hospitality is real life. And therefore, hospitality is humble. Okay? Let's put it another way. If you open up your home and your life to other people and their needs, some of the messiness of your own life will be exposed. And that, my friends, is just fine. You don't want to be a faker for the rest of your life, do you? Yeah. It's okay. Hospitality has to come before pride. Most people feel welcomed and comfortable discovering a true home in all of its real life activity, unless it's just totally horrendous, you know, and we need to, like, in your hoarder, and we need to help you. Need some help. But a little bit of mess goes a long way. It makes you relatable, right? All the ladies in here know this. Man, I always go to this lady's house and it's perfect. It ain't perfect all the time, let me tell you. It is not. You know that deep in your soul that it's not. You don't need to be an entertainment guru like Martha Stewart. You don't need to be a sage like Oprah and have all the perfect wisdom. You don't need to be a chef like Paul Hollywood, okay? On the Great British Baking Show. You do not need to be Marie Kondo and spark joy. You know, Jesus sparks joy. Jesus sparks hope. He will clean up your life inside and out. It is about the treatment of people, not about than it is more than the place, okay? The last thing that I want you to see is that hospitality involves initiative, okay? It involves some gumption and some moxie on your part. Jesus was intentional. He is calling you to be intentional. He is not calling you to be a neighbor by osmosis. If I just live here long enough, maybe they'll invite me over. Wrong. You don't know how much time they have. You don't know how much time you have. And I don't say that in a sense of urgency that, like, everyone's going to go to hell in a handbasket if we don't act. Jesus is bigger and wider and deeper than that. the speed of Jesus and the speed of God seems to be intentional but slow and on purpose. Centuries slow. Okay? But it's also being intentional about, we got one life to live. Why don't we use it with purpose? Right? We all need to recognize that we're procrastinators. And we need to be intentional about this. The primary roadblock for most of us is that we feel too busy. Hospitality takes time. And life will probably not just hand you a bunch of extra time. It's not just going to hand you a bunch of extra time. It does put you out. It draws you out of yourself. It pushes aside your comfort zone. You have to get outside of it. That is why we talked about Sabbath last week and the time that you have and what you do with it. By practicing Sabbath, you realize that you need to set aside time for yourself to be with God. And you need to set aside time for others to be with them. Starting with the one thing, just like tithing, setting aside a portion of your money that's already God's stuff anyway, and saying, I'm going to ascribe this worth to you with the stuff that you've given me. It's no big deal because I can't take it all with me anyway. It reprioritizes your longing for stuff, the stuff that you get, the choices for the decisions you want to make about what you want to buy. And in the same way, setting aside time for Sabbath helps you realign and reprioritize what you do with your time for yourself, for God, your family, and for others. It just sets it all up. You can hear His voice. And His voice, let me tell you, His voice is saying, spend time with me. The up part of the triangle that we've talked about for several weeks. And then He says, spend time with each other and spend time with others. Practice neighboring. Have the rhythm of neighboring in your life. Day in, day out, week in, week out, month in, month out, year in, year out. What are the rhythms of neighboring that you can adopt? And then what are the practices of hospitality that you can hone? You will also then see that God basically saying, I want you to set aside time for others. And it's not a popular thing to say, but if you know me, well, you all know me, I'm going to say it anyway, okay? If you have something going on 4 to 6 nights of the week because you got to be here for this and your husband has to be there for that and your friend wants you to come to this and your kids, you signed them up for that, if you were doing that, then you were doing it wrong. And don't say that lightly. I succumb to that temptation. And you know what it makes me? Busy and tired. And my kid, I can sign them up for music lessons and soccer and football and baseball and swimming. And if by doing all those things, I think by some miraculous effort that one of them is going to end up being like a pro professional sports player. But the statistics staring me in the face are that, no, that's not going to happen. Why am I spending all of my nights doing this? Being, you know, all the moms that say soccer mom and chauffeur on the back of their car with a sticker, you know. We are not even fully present to our own lives or the life of our family. And you have zero to little space for including others unless some of those nights or some of those days you set them aside to Sabbath and then you set them aside to be hospitable. You create margin. Hence the subtitle on the front of your program. A lot of us see our house as a sanctuary, and we may be thinking, my house is the place where I get away from people. I need that space. It's not where I have them in. And this isn't easy. The greater value that you place on privacy, the less likely you are to practice hospitality. The greater value that you place on privacy, the less likely you are to practice hospitality. We think and act like practicing hospitality is going to steal away a little bit of privacy and alone time that we have in life. And let's just face this fact about all of us as well. Me too. We are self-centered. We are self-centered. I am self-centered. Jesus calls us to confront that. Being self-centered is the path of least resistance. It's kind of like you could fill in a lot of other things for Yoda when he's talking to the Jedi and he's saying in Star Wars, anger leads to hate, hate leads to blah, blah, blah. And it's more like self-centeredness leads to this and this and this and this, you know? Being self-centered is the path of least resistance. And where when you are that way, there is no room for hospitality. And Jesus just says, I want you to stop. I want you to have a stop day. I want you to Sabbath. I want you to be with me. Make room for me. Practice Sabbath and make room for others. Practice hospitality. Have a rhythm of neighboring. I ask you to stop and look face to face into that feeling, because it belies the greater truth that our lives become bigger. The greater truth is that our lives become bigger when they are expanded by compassion and humility and hospitality. It doesn't make our lives more comfortable, but it's going to make your life more meaningful and richer, more satisfying. You need to have, hear what I'm saying here. You need to have appropriate boundaries in your life at the same time. There's this tension. But you don't want to dismiss the vital challenge that most of us need to engage in inviting other people in. It's not easy, but it's essential. And that's why we've chosen it as one of the practices that our church thinks is essential to living the way of Jesus right here, right now, in West Seattle and in our surrounding neighborhoods. I want to close with this verse from Hebrews. It's a kind of misunderstood verse, I think. And it says this in Hebrews 13, verse 2. It says, don't forget to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing so, some people have shown hospitality to angels without knowing it. Don't forget to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing so, some people have shown hospitality to angels without knowing it. That verse is referring to an instance in the Old Testament when Abraham showed hospitality to some people he didn't know who turned out to be angels. If you read that in your Old Testament. The author of Hebrews is not saying that you should expect the same thing to happen literally, although that could happen. I'm not going to discount it by any means. But if you step out in faith and obey God by practicing hospitality, serving each other and reaching out to coworkers and your neighbors and strangers, then God is going to be present in our homes. And we will see him do remarkable things if we do this. So I want to close by asking God to touch our hearts. I want you to just take a moment of silence as I say these things and see if they are for you. It's kind of a challenge, an invitation to respond in a couple of ways. One way is to respond here in a minute to our communion. Another way is for the kinfolk groups that I mentioned before. It's very easy to say, I don't need that. Every church out there has community groups or life groups or small groups or something like that. And I want to be clear, especially for you, those of you who are with us for the first time or haven't heard us talk about this before. Our community groups are a place of inclusion, of belonging, of becoming extended family on mission. It's not a place where you're going to be singled out. It's not a place where you're going to be asked to jump into a Bible study and read a bunch of material that you aren't familiar with. We actually don't do Bible studies in our kinfolk groups right now. We have a meal together. I want you to think about this. In the early church, when they got together for a meal, they just remembered what Jesus did. They prayed and they sat down and ate a meal together and they took care of each other's needs. They literally did not have Bibles to open up and do a Bible study. Really. They would remember the words of Jesus, which you could attribute to being just like that. But really it was about becoming kinfolk, becoming an extended family together. And that is what we're inviting you into. So the challenge would be, if you feel alone in practicing hospitality, a kinfolk group is a perfect way to be invited into a hospitable place with hospitable people where you can practice hospitality together. You can learn how to do it. You could learn how to do it. And then you can extend your table to other people, eat together, play together, serve together, invite others in, and make going to a kinfolk group part of the practice you have about learning how to do this, how to have an ever widening, ever expanding circle of extended family. Because I'm telling you, our community needs it more than they can possibly imagine. And we're going to talk about communion. The band's come on up, guys. We're going to start to play, and we're going to be invited to come to this table where we remember what Jesus told us to remember. He told us not to have amnesia about what he did. That's what it says when he says, remember me. He says, anamnesis, which is don't have amnesia. Don't forget what I did for you and what I'm continually doing for you. And part of that is God's divine hospitality that he sent his only son
to be just like us and say, come on over and have dinner. Come on over and have dinner. Have a meal. It was his last meal that we're celebrating, which is really not actually true, because if you read, you continue to read the Gospels, he goes through the resurrection. He defeats death and he comes back. One of the first things he says in the Gospels to some of his disciples is, hey, got any food? Are you extending the table to me like I did to you? I'm hungry. People are hungry for a lot of things. And that's what this table represents, that Jesus is here to satisfy us, to satisfy them. That night, the bread and the wine became the symbols of the sacrificial nature of divine hospitality. The Last Supper was a real meal, and it was to be, the Last Supper and what we do in it, was to be their new vocation as God's people, rooted in eternity. Also very prophetic. He told them, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until the day when I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom. He's basically saying, we're going to have a banquet when the new age arrives, when my Father's kingdom comes into its fullest representation. Our lives will be welcome to a banquet. And we need to be vigilant in our awareness that this community, our community, what we are and what we do and what we practice, we are a preview community. Think about when you go to the movies and they show you a preview for a movie that you want to really see. We are a preview community of the greatest blockbuster of all time that is coming. We are a preview community. And the bread and the juice of the vine is a preview meal. Our community is a foretaste of the age to come. So the table of communion is that which God invited us into as the very means of communion with him. And you're going to be invited in a moment to come and receive this meal. And here's what I want you to do. This is what I want to invite you into. Consider your life and how you can set a table for others. How can you set a table for others and welcome into this life where we already get to practice? We already get to practice together, party, what will be in the next life. Consider that as you come.